помощью Дхармы, помощью Санга, помощью Тичер. The living beings are innumerable, but I give the vow to liberate them all. The defilements are innumerable, but I take vow to eliminate them all. The gates of Dharma are innumerable, but I take vow to master them all. Vairochana Buddha in its perfect state of Dharma, Amitabha Buddha in its perfect state of bliss, Shakyamuni Buddha in his perfect state of transformational activities, all Buddhas for the past, present and future in all 10 directions. Good wishes to all living beings. Let all living beings be happy. Let all living beings be peaceful. Let all the living beings be free from suffering. Om Mani Padme. Symbol of Dharma body, Dharma Kaya, Amitabha is a symbol of Samkhogakaya, the second body, body of bliss, and Shakyamuni is a symbol of Nirmana Kaya, the transformational body, or phenomenal body of the Buddha.
So this prayer comes from what stream of Buddhism?
Mahayana. Yes, of course. And the vows, but subtle vows are from Brahma Jala Sutra, Sutra of the Nets of Brahma. And it is very popular in the Far East in Chinese temple near. We will begin our lecture, and its theme is Chan, Zen, and Vajrayana Buddhism. In my first lecture, I mentioned the sentence of Edward Conze, who said that Buddhism is meditation, meditation is Buddhism. And in the nature of Zen and Zen practice, this statement of Conze obtains its concluding expression. Because of the very word Chan, or in Chinese, or Zen in Japanese, means meditation or contemplation. Therefore, Chanzong, or Chan school, or Zen school, that is the same, is but contemplative school. The very word Chan is but the transcription of the Sanskrit word dhyana, which, as I hope you remember, means meditation or contemplation. This character has different readings in different languages of the Far East,
Chan in Chinese, then in Japanese, Son in Korean, and Tian in Vietnamese. This word is abbreviated. Perhaps no. There are a lot of homonyms. This word, Chang, is an abbreviation from China, which in its turn is a transcription of the Santa Diana. And this school has also another name, Buddha Hridaya School, or School of the Heart of Buddha. Fuxing in Chinese, Buddha Hridaya, Heart of the Buddha. Why? The main idea of Chan is to realize in our own heart, and in the Chinese tradition, in the Chinese language, heart is the same as mind, is the same as consciousness in a very broad sense, and in pre-Buddhistic texts, it is the only word for every psychical life, for mind, for heart. And heart for the Chinese isn't the organ of feeling, it is first of all organ of center of thought. And the main idea of Zen is to realize the very nature of our heart mind as the nature of Buddha. And the slogan, if it is, it can be said, of Chan is, look at your own nature and you will become a Buddha. Look at your own nature and you will become a Buddha. Jian xing cheng fu. Look at your own nature and you will become a Buddha. And this part of the sentence, look at your nature, became a technical term which is very well known to Western readers from a number of popular books on Zen by its Japanese reading, Kensho, that is, seeing the nature. It is a very special state of meditation when the practitioner sees one and the same nature, and it is but his own nature in all the beings of innumerable universes, from the very low, from the very high, from the hells to the realms of the semi-gods, and even Arya personalities, noble personalities of Bodhisattvas. It is the one and the same nature, it is his own nature, it is the experience of universal consciousness and universal unity in this consciousness. And from the statement, you can see that Zen Buddhism isn't interested in speculative thought in philosophy, in different aspects of Buddhist theory. The position of Zen is very simple. We must practice dhyana, meditation, and when our goal will be attained, we will receive all knowledge by this attainment, and in very direct way. And we do not need to study a great number of sutras, shastras, and different texts. We will look at our nature, and when we realize it, we will obtain all possible knowledge and sarvajñita, all knowledge of the Buddha. Therefore, it isn't important what are our philosophical our philosophical ideas, our philosophical beliefs. It is substantial to practice meditation. Moreover, such some philosophical ideas, religious opinions and beliefs can become a kind of attachment, a kind of defilement and obstacle in this way. And it is very important to obtain a state of Usin and Unyan. Usin, it is, if we translate it literally, it will be no mind or no hardness, but hardness or no mindedness. But it's no, its translation can't express the idea. This then character scene is not only heart and mind, but it is also attitude or approach. No, Usin is something like natural being without prejudices and a priori taken attitudes. And Unyan is but absence of discriminating thoughts. It's a very important state. And the first fruit of Chan is awakening, U in Chinese and Satori in Japanese. It's it is awakening in the very simple sense of the world, and its religious significance has a direct relation to the common sense of this word. The example of Chinese Zen master Zunmi, who lived in the first part of the ninth century. I am a king. I have a great kingdom and a lot of different... I'm very rich, I'm very powerful, but I went to bed and I had a dream that I became a slave, very poor, very humble slave. And I have forgotten that I was a king, and now I'm a slave. But in the course of this dream, I suddenly recollect that I am not a slave, I'm a king. And this is Satori, this is U, this is awakening. But when the dream over and I become a king, not only in my recollection, but actually, it will be the complete enlightenment, bodhi, and the attainment of the complete state of the Buddha. my true nature is the nature of a king, and I am a slave only in my dream, but because of ignorance, I take this dream for reality. And I must be awakened from this dream. Some words about history. The traditional version of the Chang history is the following. Buddha Shakyamuni during one of his preachers taken a flower. Buddha Shakya, all the Buddhist schools believe that their founder is but Buddha. Yes. Yes, of course. A Buddha Shakyamuni taking a flower. Shakyamuni is a historical Buddha. Historical Buddha. Taken a flower and gave it, show it to all his disciples, and nobody understand what is the meaning of this gesture. But only his pupil Mahakashyapa understand it, and he smiled, answering the Buddha gesture. And in this time, he suddenly, it was very important, suddenly obtained this awakening. He became awakened. This awakening was transmitted to him without words and without letters, directly. And this idea of direct from Buddha to his disciple Mahakashyapa. And this idea of direct transmission of enlightenment is one of the main tenets of Zen. Then, and after this event, Kashyapa transmitted his enlightenment to his disciple, and then he to his own disciple, etc., until the 28th holder of the transmission, or 28th patriarch of Zen in India. Of course, it is a legend. It is a Chinese legend. Chinese legend. Yes. In China, about 7th or 8th century. No. It is pure legend, yes. The Chinese Buddhists claimed that such great Indian philosophers such as Nagarjuna, Ashwagosha, Asanga, Vasubandhu also were Zen patriarchs. Of course they were not. And the 28th Indian patriarch of Zen, Bodhidharma, you can see him, his image here. I think as your own primordial nature. He left, his name was Bodhidharma. He left India and went to China in the beginning of the 6th century. It is perhaps a historical fact. And he became the first patriarch of Zen in China. And then he transmitted the Dharma, his principle, to his disciple, and then transmission was uninterrupted until the 6th patriarch, Huineng by name. It was the border of 7th and 8th centuries. After the death of the 5th patriarch, Hunren, there was a schism in Zen, a part of the disciples of the 5th patriarch became the followers of his elder disciple, Shenxiu. And the others, another part of the disciples following the secret instructions of the 5th patriarch himself, confirmed Huineng as the new 6th patriarch. It is very interesting that this version now is a subject of some scholarly doubts. Some experts on the Buddhist studies supply that the real schism was provoked by Huineng's disciple Heza Shenghui, who stimulated this schism. Because of his rather non-Buddhistic ambitions. The traditional version is that the party of Shenxiu or Northern School of Zen were proponents of the idea of gradual enlightenment. A gradual and very slow progress from step to step to the complete enlightenment. And the followers of the Southern School, or the School of Huineng, were the followers of the idea of sudden enlightenment, sudden and gradual. But there are, in reality, reality is much more complex than this idea. In the Southern School, there were a lot of different approaches to this problem of sudden and gradual. There were proponents of the idea of, for example, of gradual cultivation and sudden enlightenment, and of sudden enlightenment and sudden cultivation, gradual enlightenment, and so on. There were a lot of ideas regarding this problem of interaction of sudden and gradual. Cultivation. Yes, practice of meditation, yes. For example, Zunmi was a proponent of the idea of gradual cultivation and sudden enlightenment. He taught sunrising, is sudden, but morning clouds and morning cold disappears not suddenly but gradually. And this is his idea. Yes, sudden enlightenment is sunrising, and the disappearance, vanishing of clouds and coldness is gradual cultivation. Yes. In this case, there were different approaches, and there was an approach that the cultivation must be preceded this first enlightenment. Not enlightenment, this awakening, Satori, awakening, the first feeling of Buddha's nature. The first movement of the Buddha nature, which must be, and this feeling, this experience must be stimulated in sudden manner, but very special than methods of master's guidance.
I haven't worked on Zen in a long time, but from what I remember, and he can correct me if I'm wrong. That was sudden.
Okay.
I haven't looked at Zen in a long time. Like this? I don't remember exactly, and he can probably correct me, but I think there are definitely many paradoxes between the schools, because simplistically there's a school of sudden enlightenment and there's a school of gradual enlightenment. But within those schools, there's discussion of what exactly that means.
Yes.
And what ends up happening is the people from the sudden enlightenment school will say, well, it's sudden, but you have the gradual training and then the spontaneity. Or I've never heard it this way, but maybe he's right, that there's sudden enlightenment and then a gradual cultivation. And the same thing for gradual enlightenment. You know, so that the paradox, it's much more complex, but they simplify it by saying
there was even an idea of sudden cultivation, sudden enlightenment for very advanced persons, for which cultivation and realizations were one of the same.
There also can be a little confusion about the terms Kensho and Satori, which are used synonymously, that is, alternately, different people will use in different ways. But we should think that there are, at least if we translate in English, two experiences. One is a mystical experience, the other is a transformative experience. Transformative experience is at the end, but a mystical experience could happen at the beginning of the journey, and it could be called a Kensho or it could be called a Satori. The transformative experience could be called a Kensho or a Satori as well. So.
Yeah. The Southern School won the victory, and at the end of 8th century, the Northern School completely disappeared. And the Southern School, the School of Sudden Enlightenment, divided in five branches, or five sub-schools, five trends. And there was a prophecy ascribed to Bodhisattva himself, who said, the blossom of the lotus will open and it will have five petals. But now, from those five schools, five branches, there exist only two. Rinzai Chan, or Rinzai Zen in Japanese, and Soto Zen, or Caodong Chan, which are the main and almost only representative of this tradition from 12th century until now. As I said, well, the first idea of Chan is Jianxin Chanfu, look at your own nature and you will become a Buddha. The second one is Buddha. The second one is idea of direct transmission of awakening without words and characters. And the third, which is connected with the second one, is the idea of direct mystical knowledge, direct mystical insight, without confirmation by written sacred texts of Buddhism, Bu Li Wen Zi, without support by the written texts. Li stand, when Zu texts and characters, without standing upon texts and characters. Nevertheless, the monks, of course, read texts and read Buddhist sutras, and they published a lot of Buddhist texts. There is no Buddhist school publishing so many texts as Chan, really so. But there is nevertheless principal difference between Zen and other Far Eastern schools of Buddhism. Many, almost every school of Far Eastern Buddhism taught constructed their doctrines, their teaching on the basis of one or another sutra, one or another text of Buddhism, which was considered by them to be the perfect and teaching of the Buddha, for example, the basis of Tiantai school was Lotus Sutra, the basis of Huayan school was Avatamsaka Sutra. And for example, at the beginning, the adherents of Zen also used Lankavatara Sutra, the sutra of entering the Isle of Lanka. But they rejected it. They said the foundations, the essential, the essence of our teaching isn't text, isn't written word of the Buddha. It is the very Buddha nature. It is the very Buddha nature, which is our own nature. another text. Yes, it's prime principle argument of the Zen school. So we can read sutras, but it is of intermediary importance. The first importance is direct insight into this primordial nature by strong practice of self-contemplation. The other schools also practice meditation, but of different kinds, and very often the object of meditation was text. Yes, and here never.
Quantitatively, if you take Theravada, you'll get more hours of meditation per day in the Zen school. No?
In the Theravada tradition, you have pastoral monks who live in villages, run the schools, do the rituals. And then you have forest-dwelling monks who are supposed to be the ones doing the intense meditation, but, you know, just like the Zen monks.
It is interesting that between 8th and 9th centuries, Chinese Zen, Chan, appeared in Tibet and exerted rather powerful influence on the early Tibetan Buddhism, but it received rather strong opposition from the representative of classical Indian Mahayana. And there was very famous discussion in the monastery of Samye in Lhasa between Kamala Shila, who was a defensor and proponent of classical Indian Mahayana with its idea of 10 stages of the path of the Bodhisattva in the course of three innumerable eons, and the Chinese Hashan monk Mahayana, his name was Mahayana, monastic name, who was a speaker for the sudden enlightenment of this very body. I must say that Kamala Shila, he was a very good logician. He was a master of classical Indian discussions with different rational logic arguments. Took the victory over Mahayana, Hashan Mahayana. And after this event, the positions of Zen and Tibet weakened, and in later period it disappeared in Tibet completely. But Zen, yes, disappeared. Yes, and classical Indian idea of gradual and very slow path became the predominant in Tibet. Predominant, but not the only one. For example, in the Tibetan school of Nyingma, that is old school, the first school of the Tibetan Buddhism, founded by a great yogin Padmasambhava, there is a kind of practice, its highest type of practice, called Dzogchen. Or Dzogpa Chenpo. It can be translated as the Yoga of the Great Perfection. Maha Ati Yoga, Yoga of the Great Perfection. Some scholars, the followers of Dzogchen, reject this idea, but some scholars, especially specialists who study Tibetan texts on Zen from the town of Dunhuang suppose that Dzogchen is a result of Zen influence on the Tibetan Buddhism, and it has its roots in Zen tradition. And its idea is, main idea, is very close to the Zen idea. Our consciousness, the Tibetan word for consciousness is sense. It's sense, but the sense is nothing but waves of the ocean, and the ocean itself, which is the water, is the nature of consciousness, the nature of mind, mindedness, sense need. And this nature of mind presents in every act of consciousness, in every act, psychical, in every psychical act. It is its very nature. It is sudden and as well eternal presence of this nature. And when we find this nature in each act of our consciousness here and now, we will obtain the complete enlightenment and state of the Buddha. And its nature is but jnana or ishe in Tibetan, or non-dual knowledge or non-dual awareness. And some methods of Dzogchen are also have some resemblance, some rather close resemblance with Zen methods. I have said about history and the theoretical foundations of Zen practice. Now some words about type of practice, type of practices using in Zen. I will be very brief because there are a lot of books on this theme, and rather popular books. I think that one of the best one is a book of I'm sorry, one Japanese scholar on Japan studies. No, Suzuki is a classic, but his image of Zen is very specific in reality. No, Japanese, European. Kaplow is a practitioner. Another one person with more academic attitude. He was a Jesuit.
Dumoulin,
yeah. Henry Dumoulin, yes. He lived in Japan for many, many years, and he practiced some Zen methods by himself. And I think that his insight was very deep. And because of very scholarly books, he also has written rather popular but very good book which has two volumes. For the first volume is a history of then India and China, and the second is history of then Japan. When we speak about the Zen practice, it is important to note that most of sub-schools of Zen, and first of all sort of Zen, Caldung Chan, do not reject traditional sitting meditation. Dzogchen or Dzogchen. Traditional sitting meditation, for example, Dogen, one of the first preachers of Zen in Japan, in his writings, perpetually says that the most important thing is sitting meditation. And sitting, traditional sitting meditation is the only true way to enlightenment. But Lindsay school or Lindsay school rejects this kind, traditional kind of meditation as pregnant of some attachment to fixed position. Fixed bodily position, traditional, as such, the relation of Chan to tradition is very ambiguous. From one side, it is very important to have uninterrupted lineage of the transmission of Dharma, and the Zen masters have some lists of lineage of transmission of transmission of Dharma. From another side, tradition and blind belief in tradition is dangerous. And many of early Chan masters were very exclusively iconoclastic. They sometimes destroy some Buddha's images or texts. Why? Common people think that these written characters is the very words of the Buddha, and those images of the Buddhas are real divinities, real Buddhas. But it is not the point. We must understand that there is no Buddha outside our own primordial matter. And so, to demonstrate this idea, it was possible to destroy images and texts. But it was such such forms of demonstration took place only in the early period of the development of China, and when from the period of Song Dynasty, from 10th to 13th century, Chang became established and established school with imperial patronage. Such extravagant method disappeared. But it is very interesting. Such iconoclasm also can be a kind of attachment. And Philippe Capot gives very interesting example. Here, before he came to Japan, he read a lot of books, popular books on Zen, such as Suzuki, Alan Watts, and other. And here. Considered such radical iconoclasm the very heart of Zen, and he came to Japan and went to a monastery, Zen monastery, and he saw a monk prostrating in front of the image of the founder of the monastery and burning incense in front of this image. Kaplow was very surprised. Why you don't destroy this image, said Kaplow to the monk. And monk answered, oh, please destroy it if you like, but I prefer to burn incense. And of course, if we speak about them, it is impossible not to say some words about such specific form of practice as Gung Ains or Kwans in Japanese. Gung An or Kwan. I don't know how. Okay, no? Okay?
No.
Okay? How much time?
How do you mean to communicate that?
But I have material on Tibetan Kurdish.
For today?
Yes. And,
today was the last
day? When must I finish?
What was the day that I want to
do? 12th thought. Oh, I see. I don't know how to translate Gun Anyor Kwan into English or into Russian. It's a very strange and specific word. Gun means general or common. And An means juridical case. For example, case of the killed merchant, in very juridical sense. And why this kind of practice has this name, Gun Any or Kwan, I do not know. There are a lot of explanations, but I think that all of them are not satisfactory. There are some representatives of the tradition who speak that this name this name underlines the general character of general effect of such forms as koans, but I do not know. It is very different, difficult to translate and very difficult to understand. What is koan? It is a paradox. It is a paradox which must be an object of meditation. Without any analytical or discursive approach, this meditation must be outside discursive thinking. The koan, this paradox, must be solved, but it mustn't be solved by means of logic or by means of the discursive thinking. So some examples. What was your face before your parents were born? Yes, it's very then way of doing. And the speech is about this primordial nature. It's our true innate and natural face, but the answer must be given in very intuitive way, as Alon did now. I see, I understood, yes. And or such example. It is a sound of two. And what is the sound of one? Oh. I'm afraid that is something logical solution. It is the sound of fingers and palm and not. And does a dog possess a Buddha nature? And thus answer, no. It is very a strange answer. It's it is a paradox. Mahayana doctrine teaches that all living beings, with exception, possess the Buddha nature. And Dagen wrote, if we properly look at worm or frog, will see the qualities of Buddha in worm and frog. And here the answer is dog. No. Why? It is an object of meditation. Or what is that? But please answer me without any positive or negative statements. What is Zen? Yes. Yes, it's very Zenish way. Very, very, very. Yes, yes. But there were a lot of fraud, a lot of fraud Zenists. They looked at the masters and they began to behave themselves as them. And there is a very interesting story. One Zen master had a manner answering on the questions, show his finger. For example, he was asked what the Buddha nature is, and he showed finger. And one of his pupils also borrowed this manner. But for his master, it was an expression of his inner experience. And for his pupil, it was only a formal gesture. And his master cut his finger. And once a day, the pupil was asked, for example, what is Zen? And he would like to show his finger, but there was no finger. And that time he obtained awakening. It's also a very Zen story. And the last very specific Zen method of practice is Huatuo. There can be even discussions in the manner of koans, and such discussion has a name, wenda or mondo in Japanese, question answer. And the last type of practice I would like to mention now is Huatuo. Means words or language or speech. To is a head, but here it is a suffix. And I don't know how to translate it. Literally, it is speech head or head of the speech. But it is a kind of questioning. For example, I repeat the Buddha name, the name of Buddha Amitabha. Amitofo, Amitofo, Namo, Amitofo, Namo, Amitofo, Namo, Amitofo. And in reciting this, repeating this, I am asking for myself, who repeats the Buddha name? Who is that who repeats the Buddha name?
And when I obtain the answer, I will become an awakened. I know very interesting example from our life of the effect of such photo. And I have met with one rather young boy from Ukraine who practiced some Zen methods. And he told me that sometime before, in winter, he rode bicycle in winter, and there was snow and ice. And one old woman asked him, who rides on bicycle in winter? Very simple equation, but he understood it in Zen context and experienced this awakening. Yes, and for conclusion, it must be said that. Yeah? I think that all of them, because their aim is to attain the very mystical aim, the complete enlightenment, the state of the Buddha. Of course, it's not prayer in common using of this name, but. If yes, 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 yes. My last remark of
I'm having a really hard time understanding how. You can see all of this as mystical, though.
Mystical is only a word which designates some kind of practice of direct insight into the absolute super ordinary realities, which can be described as God, impersonal absolute, our own primordial nature, the nature of natures, the nature of mind, etc.
You don't find the word.
It's only a word.
Yes. You don't find the word problematic as a definition.
All words are conventional. Is the nature of the words. For Buddhism, a word is only a vasana. A habit and nothing more. And the last historical information. Since the second part of the 9th century, when in 845, Chinese Emperor Zun, who was under great influence of his Taoist advisors, arranged great repression, anti-Buddhist repressions, and a lot of established schools of Buddhism could not recover after this blow, and they decayed and passed away. But Zen and Pure Land School were in very good position at that time. They were new, a rather weak school. They have no property. They had no property. They had no rich monasteries. And they were not monks beggars. The Chinese law, monks beggars.
Begging monks, okay.
Begging monks, yes. The Chinese law were very severe in this case. The monks had to be engaged in physical work. It was very important because as a counterpart of their constant meditative practice. For example, they cultivated tea. There was even a proverb, a taste of chan is like taste of cha at a tea. Tea is cha in Chinese. Chan and cha, the taste of chan is like the taste of tea or cha in Chinese. And one of the rules of Bai Zhang proclaims, like Saint Paul, one day without work, one day without food. After these anti-Buddhistic repressions of Uzun Emperor, Chang Zen and Pure Land became the only flourishing Buddhist schools of Buddhism in China. And now, in reality, all Buddhist trends, all Buddhism, continental, East Asian continental Buddhism is but Chan, Pure Land, and their syncretic forms. I gave an example of such syncretism when I told about Hua Tou, the repetition of the Buddha name, and asking about who do that?
I'll ask about this this question itself about the repetition of the Buddha's name while asking oneself the question, mm-hmm. who is repeating the Buddha's name?
Mm-hmm.
The story that you told, the Ukrainian story, very cute story, had the boy riding a bicycle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there any significance to repeating the Buddha name or some other
sacred
name?
No.
I mean, you could sit down and say, who said it, Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola. Who's saying Coca-Cola?
No. There is no difference.
Let me ask. I got to ask that again. Is the mind going to be more absorbed in a specific way repeating the Buddha name as
perhaps opposed to?
In other words, the tension between that might be more significant than saying Coca-Cola.
In such case, the asking can be more effective.
More right. In other words, ultimately, even in the koan, or especially in the koan, I assume it's not just the point is not to give an answer. The point is to achieve to exhaust the mind beyond discursive and dualistic thinking to produce a state of awareness from which a paradoxical poetic answer itself may emerge, which it will have nothing to do with the koan. As far as I've seen, some of the answers to koans, they themselves are koans. So. Exactly. So, the focus is not on answering the question, but on the state of mind achieved.
Yes.
And I assume that's with this asking about the who is repeating the Buddha's name.
Yeah.
It's not a question of giving an answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Completely agree. The Japanese situation is rather different, and the plurality of schools in Japan is. Much more serial than in the continent. And in Japan now, Zen is the third school of Buddhism by its importance. The first is Jodo Shinshu, the true face of Pure Land. Then Nichiren,
Nitransky with its practice of repetition of the title of the sutra, and the third is Zen. The third is Zen. And I have finished, but I don't know what must we do with the Tibetan tradition. I had a plan to tell about Chan and Tibetan Mantrayana, Vajrayana in one letter, but...
I want to go to this whole, back to the question of the spontaneous and the gradual. I think that's very interesting vis-a-vis the whole notion of that we were talking about yesterday when we were trying to offer definitions for mystical prayer. And it was Magdalit who raised the question of Nilima rephrased it in terms of God's response, but in terms of you're doing the effort, but then God takes over, and the mystical moment being the moment of God taking over. It's interesting that this actually becomes a subject for theorization in the Japanese schools, namely the relationship between what we do as something gradual and rather as something that happens. Okay, now I suppose this is analogous in its own way to the notions of grace, even though I'm not sure grace actually serves there. I think it's interesting to bring to our awareness that this kind of tension probably exists in all traditions in different ways. How, on the one hand, our effort, and this then plays into the very definition of mystical prayer, how on the one hand mystical prayer is something that we do as part of a path of intention of a world structure, etc. On the other hand, there's another dimension of the mystical, which is actually when we lose control and something happens, whether through part of it is in the theorization, part of it is in the practice, like the Zen koans, where you really have to lose control of a certain kind of mind. So I'd like to ask the different speakers maybe to say a word or two in their tradition about this relationship between control, loss of control, human initiative, grace, gift, etc.
I'm just going to speak indirectly. I'm going to speak indirectly and give two examples. There's a 15th century mystic. Her name is Catherine of Genoa. And she was leading, a sinful life. She was married. She had all sorts of marital problems. Now, it's clear that she was brought up in a religious context. She has this incredible transforming experience of the difference between pure love and self-love. All right? So she's transformed. However, as she leads her life, she speaks in terms of sudden transformation, then gradual assimilation or transformation, and then final transformation, and then, of course, death. In the 18th century, there is another woman mystic, 18th century. Her name is Marie of the Incarnation. She's the first... She's the first woman missionary to North America. The same thing happened to Marie. I mean, it's very strange. She has this seemingly mystical union at the beginning of her life. Then it becomes seemingly gradual, step by step, and then she talks about a final assimilation. So those are just two examples. And again, it's oversimplified.
Thank you, very interesting.
Not at the moment.
The
in the Jewish mystical tradition in general, there's certainly a recognition of this, this kind of you call it a dialectic in a certain sense that that you're speaking of. In the Talmud itself, when it speaks of how one accesses the Jewish mystical tradition to begin with, and this is a normative doctrine that stated in the Talmud on an esoteric subject, that says you're not permitted to teach, let's call it Jewish mysticism for a moment, except to one who is wise and knows it from his own mind. Okay, so that means he has to already know from his own mind what it is that he's going to be taught. To some extent, what that means is that and typically, and I see this also just in my rabbinic experience with people who have some mystical inclination, that they have certain moments of profound awareness, but they're not complete awareness. They have awakenings, which they then want to cultivate, as you say, in other words, through various types of devotional and meditative practices. But it has to start with some kind of awakening to what's really happening here. Those who I find who are interested in mysticism in general but have not had an awakening turn mysticism into something romantic, and you can tell that they haven't got a feel for it. Those who have had an awakening, they get the hard edge of it. That being said, there are other, you know, later Kabbalistic traditions which are very practice oriented, begin with extremely rigorous practice like Abulafian meditation, where the practice is guaranteed to launch you into profound states. It just does. It's a very intense, in some cases, mentally destabilizing practice. When done for a period of time, it has guaranteed results and launches you into extraordinary awareness. You see in the Lurianic Kabbalists, Abulafian meditation, 13th century, late 13th century. In the Lurianic Kabbalists in the 16th century, you see a combination of both. The idea of initial awareness, practice, cultivating to higher levels of awareness, practice, and on to complete awareness. So I think this dialectic is the kind of kind of balancing that you find throughout Jewish mysticism. I can relate to that very strongly.
Thank you very much. I would like to add that some Hasidic stories of Martin Buber look like the stories of Zen Koans, and I think it would be interesting to analyze the structure of both.
In the Hindu tradition, both ways are theoretically accepted by different schools. One is the first one, where effort is very important. Many yogic schools are rooted in that tradition, where you start, you come with an intention, it is the intention that is important, and it is through gradual cultivation, again like the Jewish tradition, where it is guaranteed you reach a certain state. In other traditions, where sudden enlightenment is proposed, they speak for sudden enlightenment, and that's where generally the case is that either the deity or the guru recognizes in an outwardly very immoral or confused person that stirring spirit, and then they decide that spirit, which is, and on recognizing that, they decide that for this person that long path is not going to lead to that point. He or she won't opt for it. So there is a sudden, through the grace, there is sudden awakening, and then slowly the implications of that awakening open up through practice to the person who is given sudden grace.
Are traditions tend to be more grace and then more sudden-oriented?
Both, in some ways. In Bhakti traditions in the South, there are two analogies given. One is the way of the kitten, and the other is the way of the young one of the monkey. when in the when the young one of the monkey, kitten. Yeah, and the monkey's young one has to at least make that effort to cling to the mother's neck while the mother carries him one. And from one branch to the other, where the kitten doesn't have to make any effort, just picked up and carried to that.
Thank you.
That's actually, I love that because I love that. Obviously, in Islamic mysticism, just given sort of the understanding of God generally in Islam, there's at some level there's this basic acknowledgement that everything that's happening is happening because of the will of God. So that's, I think, it's some sort of, frame in which, within which I think all of it is generally understood. But there is, I think, there's exactly this kind of a dichotomy that we're seeing in other discussions. One is the sort of abandonment from the conscious abandonment from the very beginning to this kind of a divine will. But there's the other one, which is very much this clinging to the baby monkey clinging to the mother notion, and the very very strong notion that you've got to try hard, and you've got to get simultaneously this notion that, well, whatever you get is because God's letting you get it, but at the same time this notion that, well, there are certain points up to which you can get by through extensive effort, but beyond that, to that final little thing, it requires an act of grace. There's also the notion that there's also the very strong notion that some people, how far they get really depends on the person, and the teacher can judge whether people have the aptitude or not. But a lot of writers do mention that, well, do it anyway. Even acknowledging that you might never get it, you might not have the aptitude for it, but you're headed in the right direction, and when you die, whatever that divine experience, you're going to get that. I mean, and that's where it's sort of a dilemma, because on the one hand, everyone's going to get it, so why make the effort? So I think it's, but if you're predisposed to make the effort, then make the effort. There's that sort of a notion.
I don't want to speak for a tradition, but I want to make a distinction between theology and psychology. So you can have experiences which are conscious and effortful, and those which are unconscious and spontaneous. And then you can talk about self-effort versus grace, but it seems to me that if you search in all the various traditions, you find that even the effort you make is a gift of grace. That is to say, even though it's not a spontaneous experience, you're working, you seem like you experience a great absence, but nevertheless, if it in a theistic tradition, it's a gift of grace, or it's a product of good karma from the past in an Asian tradition.
Take some of my own medicine. Unlike Kabbalah, unlike Hasidism, which I think definitely makes in certain parts the shift to God as the prime actor, I think in Kabbalah, carrying over older rabbinic notions, the emphasis is on human action, and hence I'm not so sure that they would say that, you know, when you look at it deeper, you realize that actually all the power of the action you're doing is itself. I mean, I think probably the Kabbalistic notion is more similar to what Jamal says. So you go up to a certain point, and then at the end, when you may no longer be able to go, then God takes over, rather than the notion that it, from a certain perspective, everything you're doing really is God's work. But maybe Mary wants to comment on this.
Yeah. The distinctions are pretty subtle here, because in Kabbalistic practice, and here just take a whole range of 13th to 16th century meditation practices, there's, as you say quite rightly, there's a big focus on action and discipline practice, but it has two purposes. One is to give you a certain strengthening and mental discipline, but then at a certain level, it's to exhaust you. Beyond the strengthening, so it focuses you, but then exhausts you, so that you release to a divine experience. So even the action itself is not only for the sake of action, but for the sake of the release of action. the recognition that not only your goal but your whole process has been because of God's, you want to call it grace, is part of the awareness. I mean, that you achieve. What happens is it shifts from we're going to see a text from this actually in my presentation. It's attributed to Rabbeinu Israel. It's questionable whether it is, but it's certainly mid 13th century Kabbalah. I mean, the notion is that you shift from a theological assumption that this is God's action to an experience that it is, and that's part of the awareness. But in other words, in terms of the dialectic of action and release, action and grace, that's part of the practice. Practice is designed both to strengthen. Abelofian mysticism is clear. Practice is designed to strengthen your mind at the beginning and to exhaust it at the end, so that you release into oftentimes entirely different realities. No, okay, if you're talking theurgic Kabbalah, we'll be talking about an issue where the text we'll look at combines theurgic and meditative Kabbalah together, and in a kind of paradoxical way, there are such examples. Pure theurgy, it's not even in the issue here at all.
I confess, I'm still confused about this. So take this as a grain of salt. The old Pelagian monks, which of course is a heresy in, say, Christianity, the old Pelagian monks were absolutely convinced that human effort could bring about salvation. Now, they're talking about salvation. They're not talking about altered states of consciousness. They're not talking about mysticism. That would be foreign to them. So, they're talking about uniting with God's will in such a way that God is pleased with them. They're not looking directly for what today is called altered states of consciousness or mysticism. All right? A person who enters a monastery. See, I know of no tradition in Christianity, that's why I'm a bit confused about this. I know of no tradition in Christianity that says, look, you come to us, or you do it this way, and we're going to make a mystic out of you. We're going to alter your state of consciousness. That certainly we're going to transform you. We're going to turn you into a deeper, richer Christian who appreciates and has appropriated perhaps much more.